Hello and welcome to the Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Szczepańczyk. This episode of the show will be devoted entirely to coverage of the disaster wrought on the Gulf Coast as a result of Hurricane Katrina in 2005. We'll feature a radio adaptation of an essay by political commentator Bob Harris, as posted on his website, bobharris.com. We'll also include a feature about the hurricane's impact in media-related issues in this week's installment of Media Minutes. But we'll begin with these stories, courtesy of The New Standard. FEMA planned to leave New Orleans poor behind. Failing a test is one thing, but failing a test after you have been given the answers is another type of failure altogether, especially when 500,000 lives rely on your ability to pass. In the summer of 2004, having identified a hurricane hitting New Orleans as one of the gravest potential disasters faced by the U.S. public, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA, staged a mock storm scenario and brought dozens of government agencies together for planning. During the five-day exercise, FEMA envisioned that the fictitious Category 3 Hurricane Pam slammed into New Orleans, deluging the area in enough water to top the levees and flood the city. Groups representing approximately 50 government agencies worked out action plans in July 2004 to deal with search and rescue, establishing shelters, debris cleanup, pumping water out of the city, and even getting schools back up and running after the storm. Though officials involved in the scenario acknowledged that tens of thousands of residents would be without the means to evacuate New Orleans in the absence of government help, the Hurricane Pam scenario teams did not determine strategies for evacuating people ahead of time. Instead, officials predicted that only one-third of the city's residents would make it out in time and designed their response plan around that assumption. It is apparent from the general action plan released after the Hurricane Pam exercise and interviews with the press at the time that over a year before Hurricane Katrina devastated New Orleans, local, state, and federal agencies were aware of the challenges they would face if a storm flooded the city. For instance, they anticipated that failure to completely evacuate the entire city ahead of the storm would pose deadly consequences for those left behind. They also predicted that tens of thousands of residents would not leave the city, even under a mandatory evacuation order, because they would lack transportation. And they foresaw that those who stayed and managed to survive the winds and flooding would be without emergency relief for several days. Though the PAM scenario plans did not address preemptive evacuation assistance, New Orleans officials told the New Orleans Times-Picayune in July 2005 that they would dedicate 64 city buses and 10 lift vans, as well as potentially school buses and Amtrak trains, to help people flee the city in the event of a serious hurricane threat. But they also acknowledged that would not meet the potential need. According to the Louisiana Transit Resource Guide, a state government website, New Orleans has 364 city buses in its fleet. Why officials did not plan to dedicate more buses to an evacuation effort was not explained to the Times-Picayune. Instead, in July 2005, public officials began videotaping messages for distribution by DVD, warning residents to begin making their own advance plans for emergency evacuation in the event of a hurricane. According to the Times-Picayune, the messages, which were to be released in September 2005, informed New Orleans residents that they were to be largely responsible for their own safety. Authorities favored VIPs over the desperate pleas of Superdome residents. As thousands of New Orleans residents, the vast majority of them poor and black, waited for days in the squalid and nightmarish conditions for rescue, authorities prioritized tourists and hotel guests for evacuation. At the Louisiana Superdome, which housed tens of thousands of people since before Hurricane Katrina slammed the Gulf Coast on Monday, August 29, 2005, people had been waiting for days to board buses, taking refugees to more permanent and hospitable shelter in other cities. Conditions rapidly deteriorated in the stadium, which city authorities had opened and designated as a shelter of last resort just hours before the storm struck. With no electricity, plumbing, food, or water, crowds had been forced to fend for themselves against hunger, thirst, sickness, and violence. On Friday, September 2, 2005, with thousands of the Superdome's inhabitants still waiting for evacuation by bus, the National Guard ushered several hundred tourists and Hyatt Hotel employees to the head of the line. The group had been holed up in the Hyatt in relatively humane conditions, at least compared to those at the Superdome. According to news reports, the group was moved from the Hyatt to make room for rescue workers and government officials, but instead of having to wait their turn in line to evacuate the city, the Hyatt guests and employees were provided transportation immediately. Food and supplies did not arrive at the Superdome until the night of Friday, September 2nd. Also on Friday, a group of tourists were reportedly preemptively escorted by the National Guard out of the Superdome. A handful of Australians, who were among those provided with priority evacuation from the stadium, detailed their ordeal in interviews with the Australian newspaper The Age. Interviewee Anthony Hope said, "It was somewhere between a disaster area full of refugees and a jail. We knew we had to stick together. We were a minority group inside the stadium with 25,000 people." When New Orleans Mayor Ray Nagin ordered a mandatory evacuation of the city the day before the hurricane struck, he exempted, quote, "essential personnel of operating hotels and their patrons," unquote, along with transportation and utility workers, hospital staff and their patients, law enforcement, and prisoners. Many tourists with the means to escape the storm-targeted city did not do so ahead of the storm. Meanwhile, New Orleans residents without means of transportation or money to pay for places to stay in other cities lacked choices in the matter. They could not evacuate. An estimated 100,000 people in New Orleans were without personal transportation or were too sick or elderly to leave on their own, according to Brian Walshon, who served as a consultant on the state's evacuation plan in an interview with the New York Times. Over two-thirds of the city's residents are black, and nearly 30% live below the poverty level. These reports come to us courtesy of The New Standard. We encourage you to support independent, nonprofit, anti-commercial news sources like The New Standard on the web at newstandardnews.net. You're listening to The Ministry of Truth.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news relating to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Kimberly Cronick.
It will be some time before the full scope of damage done to the Gulf Coast communications infrastructure from Hurricane Katrina will be known, but the initial reports are grim. Bell South, the dominant phone company in the region, reports more than 1 million lines are down. Workers are on two-week shift rotations, 13 days on, 1 day off, and thousands who lost their homes are living in company-constructed tent cities. Cell phone service is hit and miss throughout the region as well. It's easier to call in than out, what with traffic capacity reduced by more than 75%. Most radio and TV stations are off the air, and those still on are simulcasting each other. Cable systems, for the most part, haven't even begun to assess the damage. The biggest problem for all of these services is power. Generators are in tight supply and the fuel to run them even tighter. Outside the flood zones, efforts are now turning toward ways to knit those displaced back together. Tens of thousands of people have been evacuated from New Orleans and other communities to several places, one of which is Houston, Texas, where people have been mass housed at the Astrodome and Reliant Center. Media activists are working hard to build ad hoc wireless computer networks in these particular shelters to facilitate the sharing of emergency information and reunion of family and friends. The Federal Communications Commission also approved the construction of three low-power FM radio stations to broadcast inside the venues. Tish Stringer is a volunteer with the Houston Independent Media Center. She says the lack of communication is a real hardship on the displaced and those trying to help them.
People had no information about the location of their loved ones. There was a real difficulty getting information for basic things like when to eat, where to eat, how to get my child into school, how to look for jobs, transportation, really basic issues. There was no circulation of information going on.
Even though the transmitting equipment is ready to go, local officials will not let the stations begin broadcasting. Stringer says their first excuse was a lack of radios for the displaced to listen to.
Before I can let you on the air, I need to know that you're going to distribute radios, a very specific kind of radio that she laid out what kind it would be. She said, I need you to have 10,000 radios in your hand before you can go on the air. In 1 day, we got 10,000 radios. We have 10,000 radios right now, ready to distribute in the Astrodome.
Then, a self-appointed incident commander on the scene barred radio volunteers from the Astrodome, claiming the facility couldn't spare the electricity to run the station. a preposterous claim since the transmitters draw less power than an average incandescent light bulb. Now Houston officials say they plan to empty their shelters by the end of the month, which leaves the status of the entire radio project unclear.
Meanwhile, the media coverage of Katrina's aftermath is moving from breaking news mode to critiques of the lack of rescue plans and resources. 3 years ago, the main newspaper in New Orleans published a five-part series about the dangers of flooding from a hurricane's direct hit and the inadequacy of the city's levee system. Subsequent stories reported how federal money to improve the levee system was diverted to pay for the occupation of Iraq and other projects involved in the so-called War on Terror. Very little of this coverage mentions the race and class angle to the devastation, namely that those hardest hit are overwhelmingly poor and African American, which may explain why official rescue efforts have been so feeble. A review of transcripts from CNN, MSNBC, and Fox News during the first full week of hurricane coverage by the American Progress Action Fund found that less than 2% of the 1,300 stories aired on the hurricane even mentioned race or class. As for journalists themselves, many are afraid the National Guard has plans to seal off the worst affected areas, including the entire city of New Orleans. The Federal Emergency Management Agency is already denying access to journalists looking to cover ongoing search and rescue efforts. A FEMA spokesperson says their main goal is to prevent the photographing of dead bodies.
And now, here's a Media Minute's Fast Fact. Is there a connection between broadcast indecency and media consolidation? A new study from the Center for Creative Voices in Media and Free Press suggests the answer is yes. Analyzing FCC indecency cases from 2000 to 2003, the study found 82% of the radio programs fined were owned by mega broadcasters like Viacom and Clear Channel, and 96% of all fines issued during the period targeted four of the nation's largest radio groups. The report recommends the FCC promote diversity of ownership and localism as tools to combat indecency, as opposed to going off half-cocked on some sort of cleanup of the airwaves that might trample the First Amendment. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a joint production of the Illinois Initiative for Media Policy Research at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization dedicated to media democracy. For more information, visit our website at freepress.net.
This is the Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Stepinchik. We now feature a radio adaptation of an essay by political commentator Bob Harris, as posted on his website, bobharris.com. The essay was posted on Tuesday, September 6th, 2005. The horror unfolds, worst case after worst case. I can't even feign the ability to write a coherent summary. So here's a list of stuff I've come across while surfing the Lake George region, as New Orleans has been cynically renamed, in the last few days. George W. Bush actually opened Tuesday's photo op cabinet meeting by claiming with a straight face that this administration is not going to rest until every life can be saved. This after Bush himself stayed on vacation while many thousands of Americans were dying and tens of thousands were in need of rescue and relief. To Bush's left stood Donald Rumsfeld. Rumsfeld joined Bush in California in attending a San Diego Padres baseball game the night after the levees were overtopped. To his right stood Dick Cheney, who has only just now returned from vacation and whose official website at this writing still does not even acknowledge Katrina more than 8 days after landfall. To Cheney's right stood Condoleezza Rice, who considered attending Spamalot more important than doing her job and went shopping for Ferragamo shoes even after the levees had broken. As I write these words, the receipt of international aid by Condoleezza's State Department is still extremely disorganized, and people are still dying. It turns out that Bush stuffed the leadership of FEMA with political flunkies and gophers, virtually none of whom had any actual experience in, managing emergencies. The chief of staff was a Bush event planner. The deputy chief of staff was a media flack who had produced Bush campaign commercials. The head of FEMA, Mike Brown, previously ran not a relief organization, but the International Arabian Horse Association, of all things, where he seems primarily remembered for his remarkable incompetence. Brown's only real qualification seems to be his college friendship with Bush's former campaign manager, who was himself the previous unqualified director of FEMA. Under Brown's direction, FEMA has already admitted to sending over $12 million and reportedly as much as $30 million in fraudulent claims to Miami-Dade County in the wake of Hurricane Frances. Supposedly, nobody at FEMA noticed that the storm actually struck over 100 miles to the north. The wire services are now reporting that Brown waited until after the storm struck, days after receiving a briefing on the likelihood of utter disaster, before sending Homeland Security employees to the region. And he gave them 2 days to get there. Not surprisingly, the Bush team is back in full-on spin mode, arranging staged photo ops which have delayed relief operations and diverted resources so the president can play TV victim tag, steering two unusually clean and telegenic young disasteries toward the nearest camera. If that sounds harsh, consider this. A team of 50 volunteer firefighters from across the United States, all of whom rushed eagerly to risk their lives while people were still dying, were assigned by FEMA to fly to Louisiana, not to help rescue victims, but to stand at Bush's side for TV cameras. That we're allowed to see. The bodies of the thousands of victims, however, those the Bush administration are already trying to hide, just like the bodies returning from Iraq. A key component of the baloney is the claim that Governor Kathleen Blanco, governor of Louisiana, did not ask for federal assistance. This is a lie. She declared a state of emergency on August 26, 2005. The White House's own website confirms this, with Bush's corresponding federal declaration of emergency on August 27th. Note that the White House's own statement explicitly authorizes the Department of Homeland Security and FEMA to, quote, coordinate all disaster relief efforts. Specifically, FEMA is authorized to identify, mobilize, and provide at its discretion equipment and resources necessary to alleviate the impacts of the emergency, unquote. That is, after all, what the federal government is supposed to do. That is, after all, what the federal government failed to do. When Chertoff and Myers and Bush all claim that levee damage and flooding could not have been foreseen, they are lying their asses off. The flooding was an explicit part of FEMA's own scenarios. The National Weather Service repeatedly and explicitly warned of catastrophic citywide destruction. Both Brown and Chertoff were directly briefed on the flood risk by the National Hurricane Center prior to Katrina's landfall. And the National Weather Service reported at 9 a.m. on Monday, mere hours after landfall, that levees had already been overtopped in both Orleans and St. Bernard's parishes. Josh Marshall points out on his website that the St. Petersburg Times has reported that Bush himself was briefed by the head of the National Hurricane Center on Sunday, August 28th. If so, Bush was personally warned of likely floods 3 full days before lying about it on Good Morning America. The lies are numerous, repeated, obvious, and easily documented. Remember what this is. These people are lying about negligent responsibility for the unnecessary deaths of thousands of our fellow Americans. This is nothing short of criminal. As you already know, much of the afflicted region's National Guard contingent is thousands of miles away fighting in Iraq. Meanwhile, the Bush administration consistently cut funding for New Orleans levees year after year after year. This was explicitly and repeatedly blamed on the Iraq War. Will Bunch points out that in 2004, Bush's budget actually included 12 times more funding for wetlands in Iraq as in the Mississippi Delta. People may no longer be stealing food from grocery stores, but the real looting has just begun. Halliburton is already cleaning up to the tune of hundreds of millions of our tax dollars. The increasingly overt hatred, class bigotry, and sheer callousness of many of the administration's defenders is descending into farce, as is the stupidity. No, Senator Ted Stevens of Alaska, the Gulf Coast is not twice the size of Europe. The $1.3 billion in pork you've brought home since Bush was elected, however, is comparable to the entire GNP of several entire European countries. Not surprisingly, GOP Senators Santorum and Kyle and Grassley are already looking for new ways to screw the victims of the disaster out of federal relief. Meanwhile, the GOP-controlled Senate has only recently decided to delay voting to abolish the estate tax. Until September 5, 2005, they were still planning on pushing a millionaires-only tax cut amounting to $1 trillion over the next 10 years. Somebody must have pointed out that doing so while corpses of the poor are piling by the thousands would be a bit distasteful. The possible long-term effects of the disaster remain both staggering and little discussed in the mainstream press. Effects in human health. Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Laurie Garrett, who specializes in the study of teeny organisms which like to kill human beings, has compiled a rather frightening laundry list of boogers afoot in Lake George and its environs, a regional plague of disease-carrying mosquitoes, gastrointestinal organisms, and a few dozen miscellaneous infectious diseases. Merely pronouncing all the names could make your damn tongue swell up. Effects for the environment. All that spectacularly polluted, infectious, dead body-riddled water you might keep hearing about in New Orleans is being pumped directly back into the surrounding environment. That might not be a good idea, and the water may be even more hazardous than we realize. New Orleans also contained a major toxic waste dump. Effects in economics. The Bush administration is already running ludicrously unsustainable deficits with no end in sight. The few existing GOP plans, like the trillion-dollar tax cut, as previously noted, only make the problem much worse. It's hard to say when, but within our lifetimes, this may well do to the dollar and the economy pretty much what Katrina just did to the Gulf Coast. And now, Lake George will cost the United States another $100 billion or even $200 billion, give or take. To boot, America now has up to 1 million displaced people, many in severe economic, medical, and/or psychological need. This will be costly to handle, even if it is handled wisely, which of course it will not be. Effects in domestic tranquility. When Kanye West said out loud that George Bush doesn't care about black people, that was not one man's opinion, contrary to NBC's excuse for censoring the rebroadcast. That's what a lot of folks think now, and even if you disagree, it's not hard to see why they do. Dark-skinned civilians, the vast majority guilty of only being in the wrong place at the wrong time, have been killed by the tens of thousands in Iraq, locked up in Guantanamo, where Halliburton is also raking in millions, and abused with near impunity at Abu Ghraib. Bush himself was the most active killer of prison inmates in U.S. gubernatorial history. Most were, as one does come to expect, non-white. And Bush's Supreme Court guy has made an entire career out of pushing against civil rights laws, fair housing, affirmative action, and the Voting Rights Act. Bush wants to make him Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. Effects in national security. Every terrorist on earth can now see that the United States is vastly less capable of providing for its own people than anyone previously thought. I might be guessing here, but it doesn't seem a real stretch to figure that the perceived effectiveness of, and therefore incentive for, another attack has now leapt dramatically, and Iraq has sure been a peachy incubator of terrorists. And even if nobody does anything horrible anytime soon, every American living in the likely earthquake, tornado, or hurricane zone, which is to say about two-thirds of America's population, must now realize that if problems come, you may just be on your own. It is hard to find words to fully state the ongoing damage. The bottom line is, it is exceedingly likely that hundreds of people, if not thousands, if not tens of thousands, have died not from the storm, but from the gross incompetence in handling the aftermath. George W. Bush is not our king. He is our employee. In most work environments, getting members of the owner's families killed usually gets you fired. You're listening to The Ministry of Truth.